Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Helene Silverblatt about the new book, Harvest of Blossoms, Poems from a Life Cut Short. It's the poetry of a very young poet named Selma Meerbaum Eisinger, who died in World War II. I'm very happy now to welcome Emily Warren and Matt Donovan. They are poets, and they will both be speaking at the Muse Times 2 Poetry Series at Collected Works Bookstore this coming Sunday, the 7th of November at 4 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
I'm glad to be here.
And I'm very happy to announce that Matt Donovan is winner of the Whiting Writers Award of 2010. You just came back from the award ceremony.
That's right. I was one of 10 writers selected for this award this year, and I just got back from New York on Saturday night.
Emily Warren's latest book is called Shadow Architect. And Emily, this is a very interesting book because the inspiration for and the starting off point of this book is the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. How did you conceive of this whole project, this whole book?
Well, it initially began as a collaboration between me and a wonderful Pacific Northwest artist named Dennis Evans. And we had an exhibition. And the idea behind the book was that he was creating 22 kits, and my poems were the manuals. And if you had the kits and the manuals, you could create a universe. And this idea or notion went back to Genesis, where God says, "Let there be light," and there was light. So the spoken created the universe, and the idea that we were working with is how the immaterial creates the material. So that was the idea behind it. And the other impetus behind it was just that the letters are really a central part of Jewish mysticism. And they so what I did was base the poems on one of the founders of Jewish mysticism.
Tell
and
us
I
more.
Can say a little bit.
Yeah, please
so
do.
One of the founders is, his name in Hebrew is Baal Shem Tov, which means the master of the good name. And he was the founder of Hasidism. And his notion of the letters was that each letter had three symbolic levels. One was the world or its form, its actual shape. And the second was its name or its soul. And the third was its divinity or its number, because all Hebrew letters are also numbers. And his source for these symbolic levels was a vision. So because Judaism is rooted in the Torah, it's rooted in the Word, so Christian mystics may have a vision of Christ or the Mother Mary, but he had a vision of letters ascending and descending a ladder. And so that's how he developed them. And so, and his ideas or his vision has been taken up by many Kabbalists. And so my poems, each poem has three sections. One relates to the form. And so, for instance, the letter Beit looks like an open tent door. And its name, its second level, means house. And it's number two, which is a number and stands for kind of multiplicity and unity, that we're all connected, but that we're all separate. So every poem has three poems in it corresponding to those symbolic levels. And then there's this fourth section, which are quotations from both poetry and philosophy and the Torah. And the idea there is that they're proof texts. So when you study Torah or Talmud, when you offer your interpretation, you prove it by citing other sources. So I was playing with that. So for the inspiration of these poems, I might have been reading William Blake or Walt Whitman or a forest story. And so they were part of what inspired the poems. And so you'll see in the proof text the actual. And that's a lot. And, you know, when people hear all that, they sometimes think, oh, my God, that's so complicated. But the poems are actually very accessible. So
yeah, they are. Would you like to read one of them right now?
Sure, I'd love to read a poem. Why don't I read the letter Bait, since I was talking about that. And this poem is about finding your dwelling place on earth, and it's called The House of Musing. And I'll read two sections. The first is about the world, is about the first short poem, and the second is about the name or its soul. Dwelling place, where two rivers merge among cottonwoods, where salmon scour mud from bottom stones, walk along riverbanks, scattering seeds, find a hollow bone, a riddled snag to siphon sky. When kingfishers dive for your low notes, when light rests from storing packets in trees, feel the blessing for doorposts. This next section is called The House of Musing. The trick to live without survival kits, miracles, bottled water, fire starters, spells, to stop grumbling to God and build your hut in the wilderness. No need to search or not search. Just join haystack to haystack, bale to bale, until thick walls swathed with mud appear. From within, the doorway frames the quiet of a tree with a single leaf. You're safe to examine the distance you've crossed, how you lived not knowing you lived, how you postponed this reckoning, believing you lacked desire to know. Yet here you are, listening to a leaf scrape air, your hands smeared with mud, your tongue reciting its own all of fate.
We're listening to Emily Warren. Her poetry is from the book Shadow Architect. It's interesting to me reading it. There's such a weaving together of nature and totally cultural and sort of textual symbols just in and out of each other all the time. And it's, I was thinking that that's rooted in this idea that the word, the letter, preceded all manifestation, which if you think about it, is kind of a crazy concept.
It is a crazy concept, but it's very contemporary and also postmodern, this notion that our cultural ideas, which are rooted in language, actually create reality. And these days, because of global warming, there's really no separation between human culture and what we value and nature. We can see the effects of human culture. And also in a much more simpler way, right now I'm staring out a window in downtown Seattle at Puget Sound, and to the left of me is the Seahawks football stadium. And so that says a lot about our human culture and our society, that next to these beautiful old buildings is also this football stadium where every Sunday we watch two teams, you know, fight each other, battle each other for a win. Victory.
In the process of working with these letters, was it for you kind of a mystical process of reading and going deeper into the letters themselves?
It was. I started out with this idea, a very kind of intellectual idea about the immaterial creating the material. And, but to actually design a project like that where you have an idea, the challenge is for poems, to write poems that are truly poems, meaning that they're inspired, that they are capture the discovery. When you read them, you have a sense of the artist discovering their meaning. And so it took me about 4 years to write. And so I would study, say, like the poem, the fifth letter of the alphabet is about Elijah. And Elijah's kind of a trickster character. He's a trickster prophet who appears kind of when you need him most. But he's also like a fool in which he shows you meaning it where you didn't see it. And so in this case, I was reading about this when he was in the cave hiding, and he heard the sound of God almost breathing. That's an actual translation. So I imagined him in Hollywood. I imagined there being a star for him in the sidewalk of Hollywood stars. And what he would, he's very one of the most well-known prophets. He's part of our mythology in a certain way. And so in that case, it had a great deal of meaning for me in terms of how a Jewish tradition or how any tradition is transmitted across generation through generation because of its resonance, but also because of its symbolic meaning that appeals to generations of people. And so in writing these poems, it was very much taking place in the tradition, but as an artist, not as a necessarily observant religious person. It was me finding in those stories and in the language what had meaning on a cultural level, and in some cases on a religious level, where I would, but it was always, it always happens in nature for me, where I would be seeking to write a poem and to understand the religious and symbolic significance in that letter, and I would have a kind of aha moment and an insight about my life, about the nature of reality, about the nature of religion. And so in that way, it very much did become a kind of mystical quest. But I myself am not observant. I see God as a mythological figure more than an actual old guy with a white beard in heaven. So for me, it's playing with the idea of God as opposed to believing in a Jewish God.
Well, believing in a Jewish God is, certainly has a long tradition, and you can be a believer or be a questioning person. But this greater question of belief that the world itself was created somehow from language seems, it just made the whole book made me think about that, and human history being a tiny, 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 minuscule fraction of the history of the planet, much less the universe itself, and the idea that somehow language or humanity permeates that big universe is really something to contemplate, because on the face of it, it just seems so completely absurd. And yet it's the basis of a lot of our cultural ways of thinking about things.
Yeah, that's very true. Factually, language didn't create the planet or the universe as far as we know. But language itself, its invention, became a way for us not to store everything in our brain, became a way for us to connect and to create memories that could then be shared across generations and within a culture. And what's so interesting to me currently is how, in one sense, we are information. Our DNA is a code. The way we create attachments both to community and to our life is through information. So on one level, you can see poetry just as a form of information that poets and people become quite attached to. But if you're an architecture or you're an archaeologist, people circulate information in those communities too, and they become very attached to it. So I think it's almost impossible to separate our own identities and our own communities from it.
We're talking to poet Emily Warren, who will be here in Santa Fe visiting for the Muse Times 2 poetry series on Sunday, this coming Sunday, the 7th of November at 4 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Let's turn now to Matt Donovan. His latest latest book of poetry is called Vellum. And once again, we're congratulating him for his award, the Whiting Writers Award that he just won. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks.
Would you like to start by reading a poem from your new book?
Sure. Yes, my one and only book.
Okay.
This is a poem called To a Student Who Refuses to Read More of the Inferno After Learning None of It Is True. Pliny tells us Zeuxis rendered the grapes with such care. Crows circled back all afternoon to peck at the work he'd done. This, though, too, is just a story of seeming and, like the other, untrue. I need to tell you about the sweetness of the lie, or how Pliny once likened a foxtail to a dangling cluster of grapes. Does it matter if the metaphor is botched? Only last century, scientists believed masses of migrating insects caused the dark spots on the moon. Although they too never went there. Imagine for a moment the swarm and hum, shadows alive with writhing, those gathered in countless wings. The lie is exactly the point in Caravaggio's basket of fruit. There are the wind-fallen, worm-wrought, slit fig skins, grapes dust-caked and flecked with white. These things are, and they are other. What I mean is not the world returned, but how artifice corresponds to the exact. The way this light and lack of shadow don't quite add up, these arbitrary leaf silhouettes, or how the table on which the basket rests seems to relinquish its attempt to seem and dissolves into a stroke of brown paint. When Howard Thurston, performing the Temple of Love, allows a woman to roam the air, only one boy will be plucked from the audience to join the magician on stage, to ensure beyond doubt the miraculous, to prove Princess Fernanda rises without any support. And when her body ascends and vanishes like a cloud, we know now Thurston will lift the boy towards the lights and whisper solemnly in his ear, "If you touch any of those fucking wires, I'll toss you from this goddamn stage." Evoking, as needed, speechlessness, wide eyes, a slackened mouth. Do I need to say allegory, terza rima, stars, or how in the canto where the eighth bulgia begins, without the liking of bodies, wholly consumed to the moment when a man gathering grapes pauses to watch the fireflies rise in a midsummer night, will know nothing of the wounded flesh, perhaps even nothing of the indisputable, the ooze and actual softening, the pulp and grape itself.
Matt Donovan from his new book, Vellum. It strikes me that, I mean, I guess everybody's poetry is like this, but yours particularly really needs to be read aloud.
Is that
your experience or your intent?
Well, I hope it also works on the page too, but that's interesting. The poets that I'm most drawn to myself have an attention to the musicality of language and are really interested in working lyricism on the page, but also orally. So I'm hoping there's something that's perhaps added to the poem in terms of hearing it out loud as well.
It seems, I was reading kind of randomly this poem and that poem in no particular order. Maybe they were written to be read in order, but one thing that it seems like is that you are in a long tradition of artists and poets who are responding to the art of previous generations.
I think that's definitely one of the preoccupations of this collection. And it wasn't as if I came after the assembly of the work here thinking that that's what I wanted to do, but intuitively that's what I was drawn to work within the ekphrastic tradition of art responding to art and meditating on that too. Nothing that would just be merely insular or self-referential, but would also be a meditating on making. And if, in some ways, the book is a meditation on the secular and on the human within the secular. And if the gods are stories, in part what Emily was talking about as well, if those are the stories we have and we're left with the makers of those stories, how does that work as a substitution for the forces of the divine? If we have the romantic poets, if we have writers like Thoreau and Emerson in the American tradition that are saying that the human artist, the human is the divine and the stand-in for the divine and the source of the divine, what are we left with given some of the horrors that that force of the divine is also capable of creating? So, yeah, I see the book as a meditation on human making, both in terms of the horrors and the artifacts of beauty that are also created in the world of art as well.
Did you really have a student who refused to read more of the Inferno after he learned it wasn't true?
Yes. Some of that is played up, but there was a source for that story. I was teaching in Uruguay at the time at the American School in Montevideo, and there was a student that... she was pretty rapt with reading Dante in class and then wanted to talk to me about it afterwards and said, but this is true, right? He really went there, as if this was journalistic reporting and we were just in the Inferno. But she was reading that as if, this was just another source of truth and a verbatim proof of what she wanted to have proved to her in the first place, given her beliefs. And I have to admit, I was absolutely speechless. I was flabbergasted. I never thought to say, by the way, this is a construct. This is not reporting.
One wonders what a person's life has been like who could have thought that the Divine Comedy was journalism.
Well, I suspect a lot of insularity and a lot of locked in faith that wasn't being questioned very much at all, but obviously something even more extreme on top of that too, I'd say.
There's a line in the poem, something like, it doesn't matter that the metaphor is botched, which I think is interesting because in a way all metaphors are by nature incomplete and don't cover the whole situation that they are describing.
That's one of the things I'm interested in that poem, that with that metaphor, I've actually never been able to even fully subscribe to it. I mean, it's a small moment in Pliny's work, but in part, what I wanted to stress there was the subjective nature of human art and the fallibility of it too. So to sort of suggest that even a figure like as great as Dante, or as perhaps the kind of footnote. Like Howard Thurston, I don't know if he'd be considered a footnote or not, a great magician, but that he also would be revealed in the poem, sort of warts and all, seem to be an important part of what I wanted to get at there.
You are a professor at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, previously the College of Santa Fe. Do your students, are they with you with the level of references that are in a book like this?
That's an interesting question. I wrestle with that with my own work. Certainly one of the advantages, as you were saying earlier, with hearing it read out loud is that the poet can give a little bit of backstory to the poem, so you can, anticipate the references and the leaps to come. My book also has a small notes page in the back where some of the additional context is provided. But I hope that the poems are accessible. I mean, I'm employing the subject matter that I'm employing as a means to springboard off into other meditations, not as a means of creating smoke and mirrors and obfuscation. I hope it actually, the poems are meant to be understood rather than to be erudite.
We like that. Matt Donovan is the poet whose new book is called Vellum. And Emily Warren's newest book is called Shadow Architect, and they will both be here in Santa Fe for the Muse Times 2 Poetry Series, Sunday the 7th of November at 4 o'clock. Thanks so much. Oh, at Collected Works Bookstore, by the way, which you can find on the web at collectedworksbookstore.com. I want to thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Helene Silverblatt. She is the co-editor of the book Harvest of Blossoms, Poems from a Life Cut Short. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
So these are the poems of a young poet who died in a Nazi labor camp in 1942. She's kind of a new Anne Frank. Her name is Selma Meerbaum-Eisinger, and she turns out to be a relative of yours.
Yes.
How did you come upon this whole story?
You know, basically, for many years, I never even knew that my mother had cousins who had died in the Holocaust. And what's interesting is that for many years, I thought we were one of those lucky families who didn't lose anybody in the Holocaust. And until I was actually living in New Mexico in the early 80s, did I realize that my mother had a first cousin who was actually a well-thought-of poet, or whose poetry was becoming more well-known in Europe. And I can tell that story of how I found out.
Yeah, tell us her. What do we know of her?
Right. Yeah. So actually, it's amazing to even find out anything about her, because she died when she was so young. She was only 18. But we have records of what she was like from people who knew her, and she must have affected people tremendously, because otherwise they wouldn't have written about her in general memoirs, for example. But she apparently was a very independent, frisky, politically engaged woman who loved to read. The evidence of that is that this album of poetry that she left included five or six translations that she made from Yiddish, Romanian, and French into German.
I mean, that was an era where there were so many people who spoke many languages by the time they were 18 years old.
Right, and also the community that she was from was famous for that.
Yeah.
And it's a community that even Tony Ute talked about as a sort of bastion of multiculturalism, where another well-known poet from the region said, even the fish are silent in five languages. Isn't that a great image? And it's a place where books and people used to live. Her cousin, our cousin Paul Celan, said that. It's a place of books and people. And it was the kind of place where she thrived, because she would go on walks with her friends. She would knock on their doors at 10 at night and say, let's go to the park, and where they would meet and discuss the important political issues of the day and argue about what Zionism meant, and they'd argue about what socialism meant, and they argued about what their future might be. They'd argue about poetry. We know that there were certain writers that she loved, and even when she was, after the ghetto was formed in her community and her family was rounded up, that she took books with her and wrote to her friends about that.
High school students, teachers, and parents, take note. This is possible.
Teenagers. Yes, right. Exactly. Well, it was part of how they, loved each other in a way. They loved each other through their own relationships and also through their literary connections.
And so there she was, born into a family that was, her father died. Her mother remarried. They were pretty poor, lived in just minimal accommodations, which of course seemed luxurious once they found themselves in the ghetto.
Right. And so she lived in a little house, and actually a little apartment that had just two rooms and did not have a kitchen to speak of. It did not have a bathroom. Actually I was able to visit, because the community of Chernivtsi itself has become interested in these famous people whose names were erased from their history. And my mother, who is Selma's closest living relative, and my sister and I went to Chernivtsi when a plaque was put on the wall of her apartment. And in our trips back, we've even been able to talk with people who somehow knew who she was and who still live in that building.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah. And every month that goes by, there are fewer people
right.
who will know.
Right, right.
And probably the people who knew her at this point are all gone.
Well, you know, an amazing thing happened. So this has been an amazing adventure, I should say, for me and my sister and my mother. And one of the amazing things that's happened is that because of this book and because of the fact that we were able to get it translated into English, and we have met people who live in the United States who knew Selma. As a matter of fact, one of the people we talk about in the introduction who talked about this horrible moment when the Romanian thugs were just shooting people randomly, and she was moving with her friends, moving their piano and music stand to the ghetto where she was pushed and was hurt. We met the man who wrote that book, and he remembers Selma. He's a retired professor in California, and his sister, who was Berta, who was one of Selma's best friends, is still alive in Israel.
It's all the more extraordinary and horrifying given this highly literate, multicultural society that this hatred of Jews became so violent, mm-hmm. even in her own, really, it seemed like a beautiful city.
But it's extraordinary to think that a community where many people spoke Yiddish, for example, not only Jewish people, but it was part of the language group of that community, where people lived together and argued together and were passionate together and who went to school together, could then have this turnaround where people then killed each other without any clear understanding of why that was happening. Except they were difficult times economically. There was also, I think, the historical time was also one of rising nationalism, which I think can be potentially very dangerous, where there were lots of people who were pit against one another. Romanians against Ukrainians, Ukrainians against Poles. There were lots of slaughters going on. And this became another one of those horrible slaughters where people today, I think, are finally, though, acknowledging what happened, trying to understand it, come to terms with it, and trying to recover their history so that it doesn't happen again, and their glorious history so that it doesn't happen again.
So Selma, this young poet, had some kind of love, who we find
yes.
out a little bit about
yes.
in her poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so yes, we can go back to the story of Selma's poems. What Selma did was she took these poems that she had written, these 50 so poems, and put them together into an album that she called Harvest of Blossoms. And she dedicated this album to the love of her life, Lazar Fichman, who was also, like her, an ardent labor Zionist, and was someone who was described as being kind of different from her. He was very correct. He was very careful. He was very brilliant. And it sounds like kind of constrained.
Yeah.
Whereas she was just a wild thing with frizzy hair, and she writes this wonderful poem about the little fuzz on his lips.
Right. Right.
And she took these poems when she knew she was being, when the roundup came, and gave them to a friend to give to him. And so he took these, so Lazar Fichman took the poems, and he took this album, Harvest of Blossoms, and took this album with him to another forced labor camp, another slave labor camp, where he survived. After the war, after the camp was liberated, he came back to Chernivtsi and gave the book to a mutual friend, Renee, because he wanted to go to what was then Palestine and was worried that something might happen. And tragically, the boat that he took to go to Palestine was blown up. But the poetry survived, including some lovely love poems and stories of tremendous fragility on her part. I'm sure you've read some of them, of her her sense of what this love might mean and what it is not meaning at times. And her friend took the book and went on a refugee's journey across Europe for 2 years and had the poems in a backpack. She She was then allowed to go to Israel because at that time Palestine then became the state of Israel in 1948, and so she shipped her meager belongings on a boat ahead of her, kept the poems in her backpack. All of her belongings were lost, but the poems survived.
Amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
And then how did somebody, I mean, who looked for them later on?
So that's even wilder. So there was a small group of people who knew about Selma in Israel, but they weren't connected. And it took a very long time until the late 70s, from the late 40s, so about 30 years, for Selma's math teacher, who loved her, Hirsch Siegel, to try to get a version of her poems published when he became aware that Renee was living in Israel with the poems. People apparently knew that Selma wrote poems while she was writing them, but no one knew where the poems were. And it was only because of this chance encounter in Tel Aviv between Renee Abramovici and Hirsch Siegel, Selma's math teacher, that it came to light that she had these poems. He tried to get them published in Israel, but at that time, unfortunately, they were reluctant to publish anything in German. She was German-speaking primarily, and she wrote the poems in German. So he tried to have a small volume published privately, which was done. At the same time, another interesting, intrepid journalist, a German journalist named Jürgen Cirka, read one of Selma's poems, the poem called Poem, read that poem in an anthology of German post-war poems. And it was published next to a very well-known poem by Paul Celan called Todesfuge.
Who was her cousin.
Who was her cousin, right. And because Paul Celan had insisted that in order for the German press to publish Todesfuge, he insisted that this one poem of Selma's be published alongside of his. Which means somehow that he somehow had copies of poetry. Jürgen Cirka was so stunned by this poem that he wanted to know if there were more poems. And so he went to Israel thinking, well, there were only two places where there would be people who might know where these poems are. They'd either be in Israel or New York. And he went to Israel first. And we've met him, and he went from Chernivtsi home to Chernivtsi home.
Talk about looking for a needle in a
haystack. Right. He said he did enjoy the food, however. It was well worth it, and it's great food. And eventually he found Renee, and then they found another mutual cousin, another of the first cousins of my mother's group, who gave him permission to have the poems published by a German press. And so they were published in Hamburg in 1980. With an introduction by Jürgen Cirka, as well as a significant article in a major German magazine. And that started her popularity in Germany.
In Germany.
And in the German-speaking world.
And then this is the first time they've been published in English.
Exactly, exactly. And what's happened that's been amazing is that our lives have become so enriched by everything that Selma has done and the people she's influenced. I mean, she's become a darling of certain rock and roll singers, and she's become topics of plays and music. And we just got back from Chernivtsi, where an entire poetry festival took place in honor of Paul Celan to kind of recreate their history. But Selma was part of that celebration where many, many people were gathered in many, many venues talking about poetry, doing disco poetry, doing theatrical productions around Paul Celan's work, having academic conversations about Selma's poetry, but celebrating, to me this was what was incredible, celebrating a community who had lost its history. I said that over, I feel that it's hard to imagine what it would be like to be in a place where your history has been erased by warring armies. I mean, Selma was erased, and many people's lives, not just Selma's, were erased by the Nazis and their thugs. But then when the Russians came, they also kind of erased the history of that region and taught Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, but did not teach the literature of the region, which is extremely rich.
Yeah.
And so the fact that this community itself, and this is all started by a young entrepreneur who said, you know, Chernivtsi has a lot to offer. We know some more and more about its history. Let's celebrate by having a big poetry festival, which is what happened.
We're talking to Helene Silverblatt, who is co-editor of the book Harvest of Blossoms, Poems from a Life Cut Short, and it's the poems of Selma Meerbaum Eisinger. So what is Chernivtsi like now?
Well, you know, it's a very beautiful city. It's at the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains, so it's hilly.
What country is it in now?
Oh, right. So Chernivtsi is now in Ukraine.
Okay,
so now it's in western Ukraine.
And what are they? What language do they speak there? Is it still a multilingual place?
Well, you know, it isn't so much because of historical changes. Right now, most people speak Ukrainian and Russian because during the Soviet Ukraine period, until the dissolution of the Soviet Union, really Russian was the primary language that was spoken. And so even Ukrainian is having a resurgence there, even though there's been a lot of celebration of famous Ukrainian writers that who've been from Chernivtsi. But Russian was really the language that people spoke and the language that was taught in school.
In so many of the Soviet republics, who then reclaimed their language and culture later on. When you go there, can you feel in any way the previous era, the Jewish presence there?
Well, you know, we feel things. I would say yes because there are plaques on walls of Selma's and other Rosa Auslander and other Jewish writers. There's also a tremendous interest among Ukrainians and others in reclaiming the old Jewish cemetery. So there are volunteer
groups. Is it still there?
Yes. And so even though, you know, it's not in good repair, but through... So Chernivtsi is in everyone's imagination. And so there's a listserv of Chernivtsers who have helped contribute to these volunteer groups who have been coming. But also these are some of groups from Germany, groups from within the Ukraine, who are really actively trying to find their past and find this historical and emotional memory of what this great community was. And so there are even, it's bizarre to say this, but they're kind of tour buses that go through old German Jewish-speaking communities throughout the old Austrian Empire, which of course is why there were German speakers to begin with, but also throughout Eastern Europe. I mean, in Prague, for example, there's a developed Jewish sector where I think there is a lot of tourism, and in Chernivtsi there is it's a city of 200,000 people that's pretty hard to get to, so it's not like Prague, but it's a place where there is an interest among, I think, Austrians and Germans, Jewish and not Jewish. I think that's important to say. Many non-Jewish people who are interested in seeing what was this culture like. And so, for example, there's a Jewish museum in Chernivtsi, which is fairly well organized and that offers all kinds of things to people who come and see it. They have archives that they share with people. They have they explain to people who aren't Jewish certain what ritual objects mean or what certain Jewish celebrations are, and they also talk about the history of Jews in Chernivtsi itself. When we were in Chernivtsi this last September, there was not only an opening of this museum and an opportunity for people who had come to the poetry festival to go to see this Jewish museum, but I was struck by how many people from the German-speaking world, from Austria and Germany, were there who were maybe in their 30s or 40s, who were interested in looking at what was the German-Jewish past of this part of the world.
Meanwhile, this young poet, Selma, who you can't believe she wrote this stuff by the time she was 18, was a tremendously gifted person, and you just, like Anne Frank, you just are so desperate to know what she would have been like and what she would have done, because this guy who screwed her over no doubt was not the love of her life. He was just some, you know...
He was the first person she loved.
Right, and she didn't get a chance to love again, but the potential lost in that person is just so poignant.
Yeah, it is. And I feel it's the tragedy that can never be undone. And I must say, not only for Selma, but for all of those people who died. You know, so if half of the Jewish population in Chernivtsi died during the war and were killed, And yet that percentage is much better, ironically, than in communities several hours away. So part of what historylessness, that's a term that Paul Celan used, historylessness, part of what that historylessness is these lives that didn't develop.
Yeah.
So not only was the history erased by governments that didn't want people to know things, but it was also all the people who didn't get to live there.
Right. Right?
All those people who just couldn't live regular, normal lives, everyday lives that were enriched in the way we enrich all of our own lives and each
right.
other's lives.
Right, and with those remarkable standouts that we
right.
have in every community, like Selma.
Like Selma, that sort of keep people, that give people a sense of themselves and a sense of place, interestingly.
Yeah. This is
yeah.
our poet.
Right.
This person
exactly.
expresses who we are.
Exactly, exactly.
Would you like to read a poem by Selma?
Sure. Was there one that you liked a lot? Or
You could read the poem that Paul Celan chose, which is simply called Poem.
Right, I would love to read that poem. And Poem. The trees are bathed in softly shimmering light, and every leaf shines, trembling in the wind. The sky, a silky blue and clear, is like a dewdrop scattered by the morning wind. The evergreens are sealed in gentle redness and deeply bow before His Majesty the wind. Behind the poplar trees, the moon observes a child that's greeted her already with a smile. The bushes in the wind are marvelous. They're silver now a luminous green, and then like moonlight spread on light blonde hair, and then as if prepared to bloom anew. I want to live. How colorful life is. It is so full of beautiful, wondrous things, and many lips are waiting, laughing, glowing, declaring their delight. Now look, see how the street is climbing, so wide and bright, just waiting there for me. And somewhere far away, there sobs and screams the yearning that takes hold of you and me. The wind roars, calling through the woods. It tells me that our life can sing. The air is quiet, tender, cold. The distant poplar waves and waves. I want to live. I want to laugh, to bear all of my burdens, and want to do battle, no love and no hate. I want to hold heaven in my embrace and want to be free and breathe and scream. I don't want to die. No. No, for life is red, for life is mine, mine and yours, mine. Why do the cannons roar? Why must we give up life for sparkling gold? There is the moon. It is here, near, so near. I must wait. For what? They die. The numbers pile up, never rise again, never and never. I want to live. Brother, you too. Breath departs from my mouth as it does from yours. Life is colorful. You want to kill me? Why? With 1,000 flutes, woods weep. The moon is bright silver in the blue. The poplars are gray. The wind roars at me. The street is bright. Then they come and strangle me, me and you. Dead. Life is red, roars and laughs. Overnight, I am dead. A shadow of a tree floats ghost-like across the moon, barely visible. A tree, a tree. A life can cast shadows across the moon. A life. They die. The numbers pile up. Never rise again. Never and never.
Helene Silverblatt is co-editor of the book Harvest of Blossoms, Poems from a Life Cut Short. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.